Hey guys, it's Mina reminding you to download and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. This week, Sarah chats with actor Adam Pally from Happy Endings, The Mindy Project, The Mandalorian. You can find That's What She Said wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the hosts always picks the team with the cat mascot to finish last in the division. That's Lenny, and he might be right today because we are talking about the NFC South. Yes, folks, division previews are beginning now. It's June. With the help of some of my expert guests, we are going to cover every division beginning with this one. And today, that expert guest is frequent Mina Kimes Show contributor, I feel comfortable saying frequent at this point, Warren Sharp.
Hey, Mina, I'm happy to be considered frequent. I love your podcast, love everything that you do, so thank you very much for having me.
It occurred to me as we got in touch that the last time you were on was a Super Bowl preview, I believe. In Miami, we were in studio. Warren, that feels like 1 million years ago.
Yeah, it seriously feels like ages ago. I remember Katie Nolan had a birthday cake out. I regrettably did not accept a piece of that cake. It would have been a lot more fun if I had been chomping on some of that. But yeah, it was a great show then, and certainly looking forward to this show now and the preseason, previewing the season. But definitely a very far cry from where we were back in Miami.
Yeah, I love doing these previews because it forces you to go depth chart by depth chart, backup by backup. And I swear it was a coincidence that coincidence might be the wrong word, but you know, I reached out to you. I said, let's do the NFC South, because I think it's such an interesting division. I think all these teams are really interesting. The Bucks and Saints are, you know, pretty clearly sort of that top tier, although we can talk about it, and I think they're really fascinating. And then all this stuff with Drew Brees happened, which I've talked about on all of my platforms, even on this one. You can go back and listen to the Morning Roast. We talked about it the other day. But all I have to say, Warren, is I wish I could build a time machine and go back to, forget 2016, go back to January, or February rather, when you and I, it might have been the end of January, when you and I taped, and tell you, hey, Warren Sharp, in approximately 6 months, we're all going to be in our houses. Nobody's going to be leaving. There's going to be protests across every major American city. Oh, and by the way, Drew Brees is going to clap back at the United States president. Not a big deal. Just a few.
Yeah, that would have been very hard to picture then. It still seems a little bit surreal right now where we're sitting at. But look, I think you've made a lot of progress with the points you've gotten across. I've agreed with basically every single thing that you've shared on this complicated and sensitive but very important subject to discuss and resolve and move forward. And look, I think that if we skip past where we are and look at like the season as it gets played out, if some people are suggesting that they're not going to watch the games because of some of the things that Drew Brees has said and some things that the players might do, I think it's their loss. I don't think we should do anything differently. These are important issues that we need to resolve and make change, meaningful change to. And I think we're going to be in store for an outstanding season if it is able to be played. And I don't think that any of those types of protests are going to diminish the quality of football that we're going to see this year.
Well, again, this is not a coincidence, but I do want to start with the Saints because they are not only the favorite to win the division. I believe they're the favorite to come out of the NFC altogether. And Warren, when I went through these depth charts, they're one of those teams where I thought they would win the division before. I was high on them before. But when I went position by position and started looking at even the backups, I was shocked by how deep and complete this football team is.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I mean, we can get to the Drew Brees element of it momentarily and what they've done with a few pieces offensively. But the crazy part is, you know, the last couple of drafts, they have not taken very many players. I mean, this is not a very active team in the draft. But yet you look at them on both sides of the ball and how deep and stacked they are, it's pretty amazing. And absolutely, with an under-discussed element of this team is their defense. This is a team who, their defense, based on my early down success metric, ranked 31st in 2018. And they improved from 31st all the way to fourth best last season. A jump that not as many people are discussing, but they made some really big improvements defensively, and they've added a couple new pieces I think that can help them this offseason as well. And so I think this defense, you know, they'll be tested playing in the NFC South, but they're a unit that is built well enough that it should do their part to help balance out what the offense can do and take this team.
Yeah, we've come a long way from those 7-9 defenses. Let's talk about the defense first, then, just because we'll get to the Bucs defense, which is also pretty good. I think there was a point where I was saying, the Bucs defense might be better. And arguably, you know, I think they, again, we'll talk about how good they were last year. But top to bottom, I think at every level, the Saints defense has plus players. I mean, the defensive line, for starters, the defensive tackles on this team, which is why they've had a phenomenal run defense for a few years now, and last year was no exception. But we're looking at, I think, a defensive line where there are backups or there's depth that would start on other teams. The only concern I have is they're a little thin at pass rusher, right? Like if Marcus Davenport, for example, was to get hurt again, opposite Cam Jordan, I think they would be in a difficult situation. Even though I really like Trey Hendrickson, there's not a ton of depth there. At linebacker, DeMario Davis was, I talked about this with Ryan Clark, arguably the best covered linebacker, all around linebacker, honestly, in football last year. And then they went out and added Zach Bond in the third round. A lot of people had him, myself included, mocked potentially as a first rounder, who's such a versatile piece. Alex Anzalone? I've never really figured out how to say that. Anyways, he should be coming back healthy. And then in the secondary, Marshon Lattimore, he was not as good as he was as a rookie. He's kind of been, he has not lived up to that, but he's still been very good. Whereas Marcus Williams, I think, has been better and better and better. Then they went out and replaced Von Bell with Malcolm Jenkins and Eli Apple with Janoris Jenkins. And good Lord, I mean, this is a really talented unit.
Yeah, I think the Jenkins replacements were important. You know, Eli Apple certainly did get his share of being picked on last season. And I think that, you know, adding some quality leaders and players in that secondary is going to be important. This year, I'm projecting them to face a significantly more difficult schedule of opposing passing offenses. I mean, last year, they were basically middle of the pack. They played the 17th toughest schedule of passing offenses, but they're definitely going to be facing a top 10 schedule in terms of difficulty of opposing passing offenses and opposing quarterbacks in general. So they're going to need to, you know, rely a little bit more on that secondary, especially if the team is able to do what we think that they're going to be able to do, which is win double digit games. You're going to be playing with a lead. So inherently those other teams are going to be passing the ball a little bit more often, making run defense not quite as important. Now their run defense, they are going to play a much easier schedule of opposing run offenses this upcoming season. So it's very vital that this secondary with a few new pieces gets better, as well as the pass rush, as you mentioned.
I also erred in not mentioning Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, who was awesome last year. So they should be really good, you know, in nickel as well. I want to ask you what your opinion is on some of the changes they made on offense, because I think that's where, while again, I continue to have faith in this offense being exceptionally good, especially in an off season where I think offenses that are less experienced and don't have a head coach and quarterback who have basically mind melded at this point could suffer relatively. I think you can argue about some of the changes. So first of all, there's the addition of Emmanuel Sanders, which, you know, when I first talked about it, I think it was right after the signing, it was with Bill Barnwell, who didn't love the contract. And Bill's looking at this holistically, like, you know, looking at his age, looking at the team and their long-term strategy. I mean, look, the Saints are basically a Ponzi scheme, right? Like, you can't talk about their finances at this point. Like, if we want to get into that, it's really remarkable. But in the short term, immediately this season, I just think what he does, and like in the Saints offense, Warren, like the wide receivers roles are so specific and like delineated. And to me, his skill set, which is not entirely different from Michael Thomas's, is really helpful. The other move that I want to get your opinion on is the move that I think a lot of people slammed, which was the Andrus Peak contract. And, you know, this all flows from them drafting Cesar Ruiz out of Michigan in the first round, which confused some people because they already had, you know, an offensive line, a terrific offensive line. But then they let Larry Warford go. And which I think once you start looking at it as a whole, that makes sense because he did struggle a little bit down the road. But do you think overall all of this change will be a net positive for the Saints offense?
I think undoubtedly it will. And the reason I say that is because I'm a lot bigger on Emmanuel Sanders than I think a lot of other people are. And I think the best way to look at him and look at what it means for the Saints offense is just take a look at the last 3 years. I mean, we know that the Saints and Michael Thomas came on board in 2016, but let's take a look at like the last 3 years since then. Their number two wide receiver coupled with the tight end. So in 2017, it was Ted Ginn with Kobe Fleener. In 2018, it was Ted Ginn with Ben Watson. In 2019, it was Ted Ginn with Jared Cook. We saw how big of an impact Jared Cook was able to make. I mean, the guy was a target monster for touchdowns, but his efficiency, no matter where he was targeted, how he was utilized in year one with Sean Payton's offense was incredible. He was significantly better than what Ben Watson or Kobe Fleener were able to deliver over the prior 4 years where those guys were rotating back and forth almost. Adding Emmanuel Sanders to Jared Cook as the number two and number three receiving options, non-Alvin Kamara, is big, in my opinion, very big. Hmm. I really do think that Emmanuel Sanders was a key cog in some of the things that Kyle Shanahan was able to do with Jimmy Garoppolo as that team progressed and was able to make the run to the Super Bowl. Certainly not like vital from added wins and that type of thing, but he was an important piece. He also is a little bit underrated in his ability to run block as a wide receiver, considering his frame and size. You may not anticipate that, but different teams that he's been on have raved about his ability to get in there, do whatever it takes. And that's where he's going to be in this offense, because we know that this offense is led by Drew Brees. It's a lot of targets to Michael Thomas. And then, you know, you've got these other guys that are used in auxiliary manners. One game it could be X, another game it could be Y, all over the place. Maybe different target amounts. I don't see him getting upset if his target count is low 1 week. I don't see him doing anything other than being very professional and getting the job done, whatever that's asked of him. How long ago was it where he tore his Achilles and then came back for the season? And this guy is a consummate professional, and I can't wait to see his impact there. And then, you know, I think year two, where we look at Jared Cook, and I mean, it seems silly to discuss backups like this, but even Latavius Murray, right? He wasn't that involved in the offense early on. It was his first year in, down with Sean Payton last year, just like Jared Cook, but both these guys sort of came on, grew into their role towards the end of the season. Getting those guys back for the second year in that offense, I think, is definitely going to be beneficial. So I look at their offensive moves absolutely as a net positive.
Emmanuel Sanders is just solid, man. Like, he doesn't drop the football, first of all. And, you know, like I said, there's some crossover with what Thomas does in that offense, but that's what Drew Brees needs at this point. Seth Galina, who's a Saints fan who writes for PFF, had a piece, I want to say like a month or two ago, I remember reading, and it was about how everyone, we've all got eyes. We see Drew Brees's, you know, he doesn't throw it deep anymore, right? And so you lose some of that big play potential, which normally would be devastating, or not devastating, it might be a little bit strong, majorly negative for an offense, except for the fact that he's so freaking efficient short and intermediate that it doesn't matter. And now you add Sanders, who is one of, I think, the most reliable short to intermediate weapons in the NFL, reliable being the key word, and it just seems like a perfect fit to me. But I do want to ask you this. Look, Brees was great last year, second in completion percentage over expectation. He ranks near the top in just about every metric when he played. But then he laid an egg at the end, and this is the second year in a row where that's happened, Warren. If you're the Saints, are you concerned about that, given, you know, his age and the fact that it has happened a couple seasons in a row?
There's no doubt. I would be, as quarterbacks, any quarterback starts to get up there in age like that, I would say that there is some level of concern. Is that going to be the single element that would derail this team's ability to get to the playoffs, to get to the Super Bowl, to win the Super Bowl? I would be surprised if it was just the fact that Drew Brees' age and maybe his arm wears out a little bit towards the end of the year as being the single factor. I mean, we saw Peyton Manning without the ability in one season to like throw the ball deeper down the field as he used to, still be able to get the job done. So I think that they're going, like, Sean Payton would be able to still craft an offense to maximize where Drew Brees is incredible, which is that accuracy in those short to intermediate throws. So I think Drew Brees is going to be okay unless he sustains another injury that's going to be the problem. Where I'm intrigued is an area that nobody's really discussing, and that's something that I was able to study with regard to Alvin Kamara over the course of the season. Now, I know he sustained an injury at some point and was not as productive, especially from a broken tackle standpoint. But if you look at him, you know, where you want to use a wide receiver most is inside the 10-yard line, running the football, and as a receiver out of the backfield. Like, those are the times when you're going to get the most efficiency out of a receiver. And if you look at what he has done as a receiver, he's nowhere close to what he was last year versus what he was in 2017 and 2018. With a number of broken tackles and yards after first contact and yards after the catch. I mean, his EPA as a receiver last year was 1.7. He was at 23 and 36 the prior 2 years. And mind you, he caught, I don't know how this is possible, exactly 81 receptions every single year as a professional. Exactly 81. So he was at 81. So that's why you can measure these EPA numbers and you don't have to divide by attempts catches because they're the same. From 36 in 2017 to a 23 EPA in 2018 down to 1.7 last year. And if you look at where he's been the worst is out of 11 personnel, which is where he's getting by far the most number of targets. His yards per attempt in the prior 2 years was about 7.8. He dropped down to 5.9, and his EPA dropped from 0.3 EPA per attempt down to 0.09. So that's a 70% decline in his EPA as a receiver. And could we blame it on the injury? You know, the sustaining an injury, it's possible. But I was leading into what he's done inside the 10-yard line. And inside the 10-yard line, he's also struggled tremendously. And in fact, he was outplayed significantly by Murray from a success rate perspective, from an EPA per attempt perspective, and a total attempts. If you're like a fantasy player and you're looking at how much he's used, you'll obviously note that he didn't have a very good season last year. His touchdowns were way lower. Well, he had the same number of touches, carries as Latavius Murray did. They each had 14 inside the 10-yard line. In 2018, Kamara had 34 rushing attempts inside the 10. He dropped all the way down to 14. So I'm wondering, will we see a bounce back from Kamara this year from that efficiency? Or was like kind of the ridiculous statistics that he was putting up in 2017 and 2018 as he burst onto the scene? Was that just kind of like a little bit overblown? And that's certainly not sustainable moving forward. It's going to be interesting.
You know who else the Saints added along those lines of receiving backs, and like something kind of forget until you look at the depth chart? Ty Montgomery. So that could be interesting. Another player who I really like, and not just because he's on my dynasty team and I really could use him, it'd help me a lot if he broke out, was Adam Trautman, the tight end out of Dayton. So there's some interesting players kind of, you know, possible contributors on the Saints that could emerge this year. And I think the biggest question mark of all is just simply Drew Brees' health. And, we'll talk about the Bucs in a second, but when you do this exercise, I think they're a very good football team. But I just think you can pick out a lot more holes and potential where things could go wrong. Again, setting aside the health issue, than with the Saints. I want to talk about the Falcons first, because I think they might be one of the most...
Can I add one nugget? Can I add one? Yeah. I don't know if you talk much sports betting on here, but one interesting sports betting nugget with regard to the Saints and this season where we may not have fans in the stands. And that is that the Saints have ironically, like, we've always had this perception of the Saints as being like a really good home team and much worse on the road.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Breeze, exactly. And one of the things that contributes to their performance at home is obviously like a little bit of the home field environment, the crowd at noise and the atmosphere and those types of things going for it. Well, we may not have fans in the stands. It's to be determined what's going to happen there. But if there's not, you know, that affects different teams in different cities in different ways. And it's certainly going to hurt a team like the Saints a little bit more than it would hurt others. But ironically, since 2014, when playing at home, the Saints are actually only covering 36% of their games at home. So there's only four teams that were worse against the spread than the Saints were at home since 2014. But you know where they are the best in the NFL? They're the best in the NFL on the road. The single best team on the road, they've covered 66 of their spreads on the road since 2014.
Interesting.
It's pretty crazy.
Breeze's splits, though, the home road thing, I believe, you're talking, I realize, about the entire team, right? And yep. In terms of covering all that. But I believe his particular splits, which have been fairly dramatic or noticeable in recent years, I think that persisted. Yeah, like he was better at home last year, too.
Right. And I think what gets a little bit overblown is, you know, the home field advantage, the lines maker adds some of those points in when they're playing at home, and they're really not justified, even with the crowd noise. And that's why some of their spreads aren't being covered as high at home. But on the road, they take away too much. And even if Breeze is not quite as good, the team overall, and especially their ability to now run the football a lot better than they once used to and not rely on Breeze quite as much, has definitely boosted their rate of performance and being able to cover spreads on the road.
Interesting. Quote, Matt Ryan, this is from, I think, today. Colin Kaepernick should have every opportunity to be back in the league. So, not relevant to Matt Ryan's play, but I wanted to give a tip of the hat as the world's biggest Matt Ryan defender, irrational Matt Ryan defender. And Warren, in preparing to talk about the Falcons, I found myself, I was ready to say, oh, Matt Ryan struggled last year because, you know, but I don't think he put up career lows, but definitely last year marked a decline for him relative to his outstanding play in recent years. But as I went back and looked at this team, watched a little bit, pulled up some individual and team statistics, I found a lot of excuses for Matt Ryan, as I am prone to do. First and foremost, if I was a Falcons fan, I would not be happy with Dirk Koetter. How do you feel about that?
I feel like you're correct.
I mean, and I tweeted this meanly. So they added, we'll talk about their defense later, because they drafted AJ Terrell. They could have drafted CeeDee Lamb, and I tweeted, holy smokes, can you imagine Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, CeeDee Lamb? And then I wrote quite meanly, but Dirk Koetter would still run the ball on first down anyways.
Yep. No, I did not really love what Dirk Koetter was doing last year. I think the offensive coordinators in Atlanta for a few years now really have left some things to be desired, especially with how that team is built offensively. You know, they just haven't, I mean, this team hasn't produced a winning record since 2017. Think about that when you think about offense tends to lead the way that teams go, and this team has a good enough offense to be better than 7-9 for the last 2 years. So, you know, I definitely think that there's meat left on the bone with this, with what their coordinators have been doing on the offensive side of the ball. Absolutely.
What do you think about this offense? So last year, 12th in passing DVOA, second in rushing. They went out and added Todd Gurley, who I believe yesterday finally passed a physical. So it's a one-year deal worth up to $5.5 million. The offensive line was a problem last year. They're an interesting problem because it's an area where they've invested a lot of draft capital, right? Even though this is like, when we think about teams in this point in their, I don't know, cycle that they are, like, is this a rebuilding team? Is this an advanced team? This is not shouldn't be a rebuilding team, given you got Matt Ryan, you got Julio, like where the talent is. And yet They have a rebuilding offensive line that struggled, to my eye, especially in pass protection. They chose, again, they did not choose to bolster the offensive line in the draft. Obviously, a lot of needs on defense. Do you think that they can be better this year, and how much do you think that will help Matt Ryan?
Well, certainly the fact that they had very little run game just is a problem, because that while we don't need the run game to do a lot for us, and we're going to get our most efficient production through the air, we can't have a run game that's completely absent, you know, and their run game ranked bottom 10 last year. If they can get better protection, obviously we know how that translates to quarterback performance. If they can get better protection from their offensive line and better run blocking, that is going to help Matt Ryan tremendously. I mean, it's inevitable that it would. The interesting part about what Atlanta did, obviously, with the run game in the offseason is they brought on Todd Gurley. And, you know, one of the things that they did was, I think surprisingly, many people didn't notice it as much, but they used a lot of two-back sets. They used a lot of two-back sets last year. They ran the ball from 21 or 22 personnel on 121 rushing attempts, which is not a small amount. They recorded just 2.6 yards per carry and a 38% success rate. So 2.6 might be fine if you're in a lot of short yardage situations, but when you use the context of are these plays successful, you could see that clearly they were not successful. They actually ranked dead last in both of those metrics, yards per carry and success rate, of 18 teams that ran the ball at least 50 times from two back sets. And the other interesting part is, so they now have a fullback. They brought him on board last year, and that's why they were running out of these two back sets in terms of Keith Smith. Keith Smith is still there. Todd Gurley has no experience running behind two back sets. I mean, the Rams, they don't use a fullback. Sean McVay does not use a fullback at all. So Todd Gurley has zero experience running behind a fullback. The Falcons used a lot of runs from behind the fullback last season, and they were terrible, worse than the league at a minimum number of carries from that, from those personnel groupings. So that's going to be interesting, and they can't have just these negative plays on the ground that aren't beneficial at all. But I think those two things, having a decent enough, does that be great, but middle of the pack run game along with a little bit better pass pro is absolutely going to help Matt Ryan in this passing offense for sure.
So, on the flip side, this is a defense that it repeatedly has had bizarre splits. I didn't look this up, so I'm just shooting from the hip here. But first of all, the Falcons overall last year, I think, went 6-2 to end the season, right? After starting 1-7, that's how that math shakes out. But they played mostly bad teams, except they beat the Saints, and then there was that weird Niners game, which I really want to rewatch because it's so insane. But for the most part, played easy offenses, and the defense really turned things around. There were some changes on the coaching side, right, where they let Raheem Morris get involved in the defense. But I think there's, because of the nature of the competition, and my friend Bill Barnwell pointed out that I think they were unusually, like, abnormally good on third down or something that's not sustainable. But they are the Falcons defense in recent years has been like this, where they, I want to say it was not, maybe not, it might have been the year before where they were, like, horrible, and then they were good, and they were horrible again. Like, there's no middle ground with this defense. There's a lot of question marks. You've got Keanu Neal coming back from injury. I thought Deion Jones looked really good at the end of the season, and there's reason to believe he'll continue to play at that level. You have parted ways with Vic Beasley, and you've replaced him with Dante Fowler. So now you potentially have a defensive line of Tack McKinley, who I think has been intermittently good. Fowler, who's okay. Grady Jarrett, who's phenomenal. We love Grady Jarrett here. I think there's potential for this defensive line and linebacking group to be okay, the front seven, but I just cannot see this secondary, which, as you know, parted ways with Desmond Trufant, being above average.
No, and I think, first of all, we know that their schedule is absolutely going to be brutal. I'm forecasting the most difficult schedule of opposing quarterbacks, but taking it to, like, the bigger picture and touching on some of the stuff that Bill Barnwell mentioned, but even going beyond that, this was a defense, like using my early down success rate metric, since Dan Quinn has come to town, has ranked 31st, 27th, 30th, 29th. And then last season, they were abysmal in that as well. They ranked 29th, but they were much worse when Dan Quinn was still calling plays on the defensive side of the football. I do not know. I think it must be. There's only one reason why. It's got to be the personnel with what he had in Seattle, that the players themselves, the guys, and you know Seattle better than I do, obviously, but the guys he had in Seattle helped with his scheme much yeah. more than what he's implementing here in Atlanta. And as a defensive-minded head coach in today's NFL, for you to put defensive numbers up like this consecutive years in a row, in a row, in a row, should be enough to probably get you fired. And I think that's exactly why he started 2019 and he fired his DC in 2018 at the end of the year, which is, I think, his second one that he's used. And he said, I'm going to call the plays this year. And if we're going to go down with the ship, I'm going to go down with the ship if we don't do well on defense. But, you know, I need to be calling the plays. I can't pin the blame on somebody else because I just fired the last guy. So he calls plays for the first 8 weeks of the season, goes against the NFL's 13th easiest schedule of passing offenses, and is terrible. They rank 32nd in the NFL in terms of their overall pass defense, whether it's yards per attempt, success rate, EPA, passer rating, touchdown to interception ratio, sack rate, every single thing. They were bottom five in the NFL. They were absolutely abysmal. Third down conversion percentage dead last, takeaways dead last, red zone defense dead last, 1-7 record through the first 8 weeks. They have a bye. Boom. What comes back after the bye? Like you said, Raheem Morris, who was actually coaching their wide receivers, even though he has a defensive background, he comes in. They got Jeff Ulbrich, who's their linebackers coach. What's interesting is Ulbrich calls plays on first and second down. Morris calls plays on third down and in the red zone. Sounds extremely complicated. They're making the change midseason, and they now go up against the third toughest schedule of pass offenses the rest of the way. And they end up going from basically last to first, from worst to first. The third down conversion rate, as Bill Barnwell mentioned, dropped from 53% down to 38%, literally worst to first. The red zone conversion rate from 66% to 38%, that's dead last to fifth best. They were tremendous with that change, but my concerns are along the lines of what he said, so I won't go into all the detail there, but at the end of the day, those two things are less likely to carry over, and their early down production later in the season was still not great. So that's the first thing I'm worried about in 2020 is that, yeah, you did better late, but that was mainly because of these third downs and red zone situations. In addition to that, you know, there's a big element of surprise. It's not like Dan Quinn goes out before the bye week and says, guess what? I'm going to fire myself as defensive coordinator. I'm going to promote these guys. Here's how we're going to call things. Nobody knew. So when they come out of the bye week and they start making these changes and different guys are calling plays and they end up going and beating the Saints 26-9 right out of the bye week in a massive upset, like whitewashed the Saints that week, they're doing things that these other offensive coaches weren't yeah. prepared for. That's going to wear off.
But I think certainly what your point about Quinn in particular coming from that Seattle defense, it's something we have seen across the NFL, which is it no longer, I don't want to say like that cover three, it no longer works, but it is so predicated on talent. Mm-hmm. And it's the same, it's what we saw in Dallas, right? Where, Chris Richard came from that tree and yep. it stopped working. And it turns out you need an Earl Thomas in 2020, quite frankly. And I think, the fact that they will be, I totally agree with you and Bill about, look, they're not going to have the same level of success they did on the stretch for all of the reasons we just described, but I imagine they could be closer to average than they did, you know, certainly in the first half last season. I think Fowler over Beasley is an upgrade. Like I said, I'm high on some. They actually finished with very impressive pass rushing numbers. Second in pass rush win rate. I hate saying that phrase. Pass rush win rate, seventh in adjusted sack ratio. Part of the reason they didn't finish terribly in defensive DVOA against the pass was because the rush was good, even though the coverage wasn't quite there. They are young in the secondary, so one thinks another year will help. Obviously, A.J. Terrell is expected to come in and start on the outside. So to wrap it up, I do think that there's a pretty clear upper and lower class in the NFC South, and I think it's the Saints and the Bucks. But I think the Falcons are one of the higher variance teams in the league because I think the defense they don't have to be better, but there's potential to be better. And I think Matt Ryan is still a good quarterback. I love you, Matt. All right, let's take a quick break and then take some questions.
Question. Question. Lenny, for your thoughts.
As always, thank you guys so much for listening and for your very thoughtful questions. Just going to take a few today. I'm looking at the iTunes reviews. Question number one comes from Jin HDJ, DJ, I don't know. It says, I'm just going to read it because I feel that it should be read in full. And Warren, I would appreciate if you took this question. Mina, you are the best. Your pods are a treat. You deserve all the stars, all caps, except for your Luke Kuechly slander. How dare you? Watch the 2015 Thanksgiving Cowboys-Panthers game, I remember, and say with a straight face that Luke isn't the best middle linebacker of the last decade. Warren, I think I said it was Bobby Wagner. But in my defense, Bobby Wagner was on the podcast.
Well, we just talked about the personnel that Dan Quinn had in Seattle and how great they were. I don't know. At some point, it's like you're picking nits between which guy is slightly better than the other. I think both of those players were fabulous. But unfortunately for them, you know, middle linebackers in today's football is not quite the same value as what they once were. But
yeah, they're kind of 1A and 1B. I'm excited to do the NFC West pod because I think the Seahawks defense, you know, we talk a lot about like how could they possibly play so much base last year. And it's very interesting to see sort of the stress that put on Wagner in particular, you know, who struggled a little bit at times because of that, because I think he was put in a really challenging position, but again, continued to play at a very high level. But we'll talk about that when we talk about the NFC West. Johnny Wiss asks, if you do a cross pod with another podcast, who would you choose? Well, what do they call when you're on a TV show and then a crossover episode? I was just tweeting with Chris Long about doing a podcast together at some point. If you guys would like that, shoot a tweet at me. Warren, what would be your dream podcast to appear on?
I don't know. I saw your interaction with Chris. I think he's a very good, podcaster, a good guy to be, to do some stuff with. He covers a lot of topics, you know, music and current events and all those different types of things. So and plus he's got the good locker room NFL experience and Super Bowl rings and that sort of thing. So that would be pretty fun for you. Geez, I don't know. I love coming on your show and, I just try to put out content where I can. So I can't really name, what my dream scenario would be. I'm just, my head is just buried in writing this book right now. So I'm not really creative thought process mode right now for me.
Tell us about the book.
Well, it's just my 2020 football preview, and we're going much deeper than I've done in the past, including some really cool visualizations, some heat maps. I shared a couple of those with you about the Bucks, who we're going to talk about momentarily, but that book is going to be out beginning of July. It's for pre-order on the website right now. But yeah, really excited about finishing it. You know, the late nights till 2:30 and 3 a.m. will pay off.
Well, I read that every year, and I will certainly share the link. And if you guys want to be smarter about football, I encourage you to read it as well. It's very useful. It's kind of like this division preview thing. It's like every summer there are like certain steps I go through to kind of get caught up and refreshed and reimmerse myself in these teams, and that is always one of them. Just one more question, and I think this is an interesting one, and I want your take. I brought it up with Corey from the Ravens, but he couldn't really answer it given his job, but I think you can. Evan Chang, 811, wants to know, if there wasn't a 2020 NFL season, what should happen with the 2021 draft order? Who gets Trevor Lawrence? So let me ask you, Warren, how would you decide? Let's say there wasn't a season. How would you decide the 2021 draft order?
Wow. I literally have never thought of this question before. So that is off the top of my head. I don't think you can go in the same order that you just went. I think that's a massive advantage to those teams. So you got to throw that out the window to begin with. I don't know. I mean, if there's obviously going to be a far more scientific, diplomatic way to do it, but you might do average of the records of the last 4 years, let's say.
That's what I would
teams
do.
Rotate on a 4-year basis. And in terms of the schedules and the different divisions that they're playing, I would go last 4 years, what's your average record? And then we do, you know, reverse order from there.
Yeah, I would, that's exactly what I would do. I think you'd just, it'd be a matter of deciding 3, 4, or 5 years, one of those. Mm-hmm. You'd be rewarding perpetual media. I guess the Bengals might still, how do they do the season? Actually, I that might not be right. I'm trying to remember how bad the Dolphins would certainly be in the mix. The funny thing is, it might not actually be that different.
It would definitely hurt a team like the Patriots, right? Who perpetually are the best team, and now they don't have Tom Brady anymore. Where are they going to go? Like, they might be worse than obviously what they've been producing in prior years. So they would be hurt more than some of the cellar dwellers, perennial cellar dwellers. I think a team like the Arizona Cardinals would be interesting because we already know that if they've got their quarterback, right, with Kyler Murray, then they would definitely benefit from having, you know, several years of bad production mixed into kind of where they're headed right now.
Or teams like, well, the Bengals and the Dolphins, again, they already got their quarterback, right? So going into next year, they could do whatever they want. Trade
yep,
down.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you mentioned one Thomas Edward Brady or Patrick. I forget. I think it's one of the two. Tom Brady is the quarterback of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He is being really hyped right now. I have seen him appear very high on various types of rankings, expectations for the season, hypothetical drafts, which has been a fun exercise that you heard first on the Media Kimes show featuring Lenny with Nate Tice, where we took him like 20th, 25th, maybe, I don't know. He went a lot higher in our ESPN draft. But I have mixed feelings about that, Warren, because I think Tom Brady was not as bad as he seemed last year. I think he was in a very bad situation playing with very bad wide receivers. But I also think it's insane to hear people talk about him like he's still a top five quarterback in the NFL.
Well, the good news for Brady is that you're not going to find really any quarterbacks, regardless of how good they are, that are going to complain that much about Bruce Arians. I mean, people love playing with Bruce Arians. So I think that that's an important factor in Tom Brady being able to enjoy and the experience, because there's going to be growing pains. There's going to be difficulties moving into a completely different system. So the fact that you're working with a guy like Bruce Arians definitely helps. But you're right. In terms of like where he currently is with a lot of these younger guys who can do more things, I think that it definitely pushes him down the list. Plus, if you have to factor in a little bit of the potential for fragility, we know the Bucs O-line wasn't nearly as good as he doesn't have an O-line coach like he had with the Patriots for so many years, and that's important for that pass pro. I'm interested to see the kind of like what his mental ability brings to the table, that perhaps like his ability to anticipate and to get into good plays, how that is leveraged against kind of maybe his lack of other physical traits that maybe Jameis Winston wasn't able to do as much. Picking the perfect play. Needless to say, being able to actually see 2020 down the football field.
Jameis Winston versus Tom Brady is like a perfect case study for how much quarterbacks impact offensive line, right? Which, what is it? Mm-hmm. Sacks are not an offensive line stat or something is the nerd sort of statement right now, or theory. Tom Brady is an offensive line's best friend, and he could not be walking into like a better situation. I mean, he could hypothetically, but you know, this Evans and Arians, Bruce Arians, we should talk about this. You know, he came out and said he's going to run more 12 this year, which we know Brady likes. So you're looking at Evans, Godwin, who everyone listeners know I'm obsessed with, and I think is like a perfect weapon for Brady. Howard, Gronk, and then you got Brayden there, so you could throw in some 13 as well. That's a remarkable come up for Brady in terms of personnel, even if the offensive line is a little bit worse. And I think this Bucs offensive line, people are going to watch them this year and think, whoa, they're a lot better. And I think a lot of it's going to be because of Brady. I also think they weren't as bad last year as Jameis made them look sometimes. So I think he is going to play better just by, you know, I think virtue of his situation. I do worry a little bit about the off-season factor, because there's no quarterback in the NFL who I think depends more or I guess prioritizes timing and anticipation than Tom Brady and being on the same page as his receivers. And I think I wouldn't be surprised. Let me put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if the Bucs offense we see in September looks very different from the Bucs offense we see in December.
I would definitely agree with that statement. I think, you know, there's a couple of things that would have made this, and that's true, mind you, for a variety of different players. When you got new coaches and new quarterbacks, especially moving systems out, I think it's going to be fascinating to see where these passing offenses are in particular now versus where they are mid-season. And one of the things that I know, I think that there could be too much made of this, but it is a fact that most teams at this time of year with mini camps are not working on the run game. They're working on their pass game, their timing, and some of the offensive things that they want to do. And they can't do that right now. So a lot of this passing offense is going to be installed much closer to the start of the season than it typically is. And I do think that that's going to impact potentially, maybe not to a massive extent, but various different teams are going to be more impacted with how they come out the gates in terms of timing, precision, and efficiency out of the passing game. But the two big things that are going to be adjustments for Brady with regard to this offense that he wasn't dealing with up in New England, the first one obviously is pretty evident, the depth of target. I mean, the Bucs averaged 10.2 air yards per pass attempt, number one in the NFL. The Patriots were down at 7.7. That was 21st in the NFL. Now, we know that that's in part because they didn't have the wide receivers like the Bucs had. So naturally, you're going to be throwing the football deeper. But in 2018, Tom Brady and the Bucs were down at 7.4 air yards per attempt, which is 23rd. Particularly on first down is where the difference is going to be. And that's where you could see in some of those heat maps that I was looking at. The Bucs averaged 13 air yards per pass attempt on first down, number one in the NFL. And the Patriots were down at number 26 with only 7.1. So I think the depth of target is a big thing. And then another change from New England to Tampa Bay is Bruce Arians doesn't use a lot of pre-snap motion. In New England, that was like their bread and butter. They use the second most amount of pre-snap motion in the first three quarters of the game, 65% of the time. Tampa Bay was down at 37% usage rate, which was below average. So that's a big difference. One of the similarities I think that we will see is slightly lower rate of play action, but big production off of it. Both teams use below average rates of play action, but they get a lot of production out of that play action. So I think Brady's going to still be able to generate a lot of good production out of the play action. But, you know, that pre-snap motion, he used a lot to help identify matchups and mismatches and where he wanted to go with the football before they snapped it. So I'm really going to be interested to see if they use more of it because he wants to or if they don't. That's going to be fascinating.
That's interesting. And I didn't know that about the Bucs using so little pre-snap motion. It's not a number I thought. And it's surprising because I think, again, Chris Godwin, I think, would be so effective in that capacity. Imagine they're going to, like, so what you're describing, right, this vast gulf between the Patriots offense historically, although the Patriots offense has been through so many iterations, it's kind of hard to characterize, but recently, and what Arians does, they're going to have to meet in the middle. Right? Like, that's what we're, I mean, even him coming out and saying, yeah, he's a lot 12, like, there's, I think, going to be some sort of adjustment period. And I think they have the tools to do, like, they have the personnel to meet in the middle and do so effectively. Like, when you talk about getting that big production off of play action, hello, Mike Evans, right? When we talk about, okay, maybe more of a screen game, hello, Chris Godwin. Like, I think they have the players to pull it off. And look, here's the thing, Warren, like, even if Brady isn't awesome, even if he's just like a top above average quarterback, which is totally likely this year, they're still going to benefit greatly. And I still think this is a very competitive team because he didn't turn the ball over. And last year, the Tampa Bay defense, which was very good, we've talked about it many times. At this point, it's no longer, it used to be like one of those kind of hipster things to say, like, oh, did you know the Bucs defense is actually really good? I think now it's kind of reached the mainstream. But last year, their average starting position was their opponent's 31.3 yard line, second worst in the NFL. That is not going to happen this year. You know, like, it's The defense, which I already think is going to be better, even though they largely kind of stayed in place and added Antoine Winfield, they're just going to be older, another year under Todd Bowles, and they're no longer going to have a quarterback that puts them in terrible positions.
Yeah, definitely on all of those. I think the craziest part was how much of what Jameis Winston struggled with truly was his eyesight. It's fascinating to try to speculate. I will say this. One of the cool things about what Bruce Arians does and what he did last year was he used that 12 personnel to get the defenses to put 8+ defenders in the box. And then they didn't run against it. They actually had one of the highest pass rates, the second highest pass rate of pass rates against 8+ defenders in the box. So they were intelligent not to run the football in those situations. But listen to this. Against stacked boxes last year, the NFL, across the entire NFL, there were 23 interceptions thrown against stacked boxes the first three quarters of the game on early downs. Okay, 23 total. Winston threw 6 of the 23 himself. 6 of the 23 across everything. So he was absolutely terrible. And Brady, you're right. He's going to make more intelligent decisions to prevent those types of turnovers. And clearly, you know, like you said, I think it is becoming a little bit more mainstream with what Todd Bowles was able to accomplish last season, but it still is worth discussing. Like, this team was one of the highest priced defenses of 2018. They shed $20 million of salary cap space from their roster on the defensive side of the football and jettisoned up the board in terms of their production. They were the number one defense against the run, and that was against the fourth toughest schedule of run offenses. So they were crushing deep teams. You could not run against them. You had to throw. The problem was their secondary really wasn't good. And if we look at where they are this year, you know, they were a 5-win team in 2018, a 7-win team in 2019. We're projecting that they're going to have a winning record this year, which means that teams are going to need to throw more against that secondary. So you could be great stopping the run, but if teams in the second half aren't going to run that much because they need to pass because they're trailing, they're going to need to step up that defensive production in the secondary. And I think that could be the big difference as to whether or not this team has enough in the tank to get as far as they want to is going to be how well that secondary can improve over what they did in 2019.
That's the big question mark, because they're so young. And, you know, like when we compare them to the Saints, right, like where that secondary is so experienced now, especially with the Jenkins eye, I think even though they really looked better over the second half of the season, Carlton Davis, Sean Murphy Bunting, who's one of my favorite named players because Sean Murphy is the name of The Good Doctor, which is a show I've never seen, but commercials for The Good Doctor run on television all the time, so I feel like I have seen it. Anyways, it's Dr. Sean Murphy. And then, you know, Antoine Winfield Jr., he's a baby! He's a baby! It's very upsetting to me that he's in the NFL, frankly, because it makes me feel extremely old. But great player. You know, there's so much potential here. But, like, look, Shaq Barrett's going to regress. Okay. I like him. I think he's been consistently a good player, but he's not going to be the best pass rusher in the NFL every year. Maybe just more likely than not. So you're right. This is actually a good transition to the final team because, to talk about the Panthers, I went back and watched the Teddy highlights from the games he played, and he got a lot better as he went on. And we'll talk about that in a moment, but, he played his best games, I thought, were the Bucs and the Bears. The Bucs, who he lit up, when I went back and watched, holy smokes, that defense was bad in week 5. Like, Teddy deserves a lot of credit. He made some really clutch throws. Again, we'll talk about him at length. But that secondary was awful at the beginning of last season. And I don't think they were awful at the end of the season. But, you know, it is... They're still very young. I'll say that. So, let's talk about the Panthers. I think universally seen as the number 4 team in the division. In recent weeks, Warren, or throughout the offseason, I've expressed some confusion about, are they rebuilding? Are they trying to compete? What's their plan? To me, looking at all the moves they've made in aggregate and sort of how this team approached the draft, it seems to me like they are kind of trying to do both at the same time. You know, they're seeing what kind of upside they can get from Teddy, who they got in a reasonable contract, while fully rebuilding this defense. Do you think they will be competitive in 2020?
I think it's definitely going to be a growing process for them this year. Definitely a transition year. At some point, though, like, I do see how they could exceed their 5.5 game win total. When you look at this Teddy Bridgewater in general, right, we know that the way that Sean Payton coordinated, I know we're going to talk momentarily about how he improved, but like a lot of short stuff, a lot of stuff Teddy would be able to do well. And you got to think that Sean Payton is well ahead of Joe Brady in that sense, but Joe Brady will craft an offense, should craft an offense to do some of the things that Bridgewater could do best and could execute best on. But Bridgewater, I mean, in his career, it is insane. I don't know if people are tracking this closely enough. His teams, when he started games, he is 31-9 against the spread. That's 78%. His teams are ridiculous. And, you know, I think that it's important to also note that the teams that he's played on, where he's played and started some games for that team, those teams have gone a perfect 4-0 to exceeding their projected win totals. So every single team that he's played won more games than they were projected to win. And in this case, Carolina's projected to win 5.5. But, you know, a few considerations. Obviously, we know stacked division, very difficult from that perspective. And, you know, the schedule itself is certainly not easy. Their overall efficiency is like one of the top 10 most difficult schedules of just opposing team efficiency in the league. So it is going to be a challenge, but I think at least we have low expectations heading into it. So I really feel like it would be a shock to see this team win only a couple of games. I definitely see them being as a team that's more competitive than that. It's just, I'm not quite sure what the ceiling is.
Teddy's only 27. Isn't that crazy? I tweeted this, but I want to discuss it with you, which is, while, again, watching him across the games, the Seahawks game, I remember he really didn't do anything. Through the end, one thing you noticed is his increasing willingness to take risks, right? And his comfort with his protection. And, you know, the Saints have one of the best offensive lines in the NFL, if not the best, you could argue. It got me thinking about Teddy and his career and just like how much quarterback development depends on where you end up, because, you know, ending up in Minnesota where he did, I think exacerbated some of his worst tendencies, playing behind a bad offensive line in an offense where he wasn't asked to do a ton at times. And it got, you know, I was like, man, what if he had just been with the Saints from the start? Like, this sort of development, I really believe you saw it last year. What if that's something he had done earlier in his career? Unfortunately, Warren, he's going to Carolina. So once again, you know, he's not playing behind a very good offensive line. I do think they have a sneaky, nice set of weapons, I will say. I think that wide receiver group, DJ Moore, Curtis Samuel, Robbie Anderson is actually pretty fun, and it's like a really complementary group with guys who have very different skill sets. But I worry a lot about the protection and whether or not Teddy will, you know, resume his check downy ways behind that offensive line.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, the interesting part when we're talking about where Teddy has been, if we just want to look at what he did last year with Drew Brees, right? We were talking about how he was maybe a little bit conservative early and then he got a little bit more aggressive. I think it's important to note, if you look at some of these player tracking data points here, Teddy's expected completion percentage was 0.7% different than what Drew Brees. Drew Brees, on the passes when he dropped back and attempted the pass, his expected completion percentage based upon where the defender is at the time of when he's passing and how far down the field he's passing and the area he's passing to, Drew Brees was expected to complete 68% of his passes. Teddy Bridgewater was expected to complete 67.3% of his passes. So very similar in terms of the expected completion percentage and the aggressiveness rank, which looks at like how often you're throwing the ball into close windows and things of that nature. He was dead on exactly the same aggressiveness rank in terms of where the league stood, 1 to 39 quarterbacks that qualified, he and Breeze were literally tied for number 32 in terms of aggressiveness rank. So it's not as if Teddy was like so much worse and did things so much different than Drew Breeze. Like he was very similar and doing a lot of the same things that Drew Breeze was doing last season from that perspective. I do agree there is some talent here. You add Robbie Anderson to this mix. I think you do have an interesting mix of players. The one thing that does concern me, like I really like DJ Moore, killer year last year. Teddy Bridgewater, Christian McCaffrey, like excellent player. Number one, you know, I like throwing the ball to running backs on early downs, but I don't suggest that you just funnel so many targets that you're not looking at some of the other players on the field who maybe are running deeper routes that could have decent success. Right. What I don't like doing is calling a lot of run plays. I'd rather transition some of those rushing attempts to targets to the running backs. But Curtis Samuel, he was shocking in terms of what he did in the slot last season. When he lined up in the slot, he was not very productive whatsoever. He caught 74 of his 104 targets, came in 11 personnel. He averages 4.5 yards per attempt and a 35% success rate on those targets. Not very good whatsoever, whereas like the other targeted players on the offense were much higher than he was in the slot. So hopefully Joe Brady is going to get more out of Curtis Samuel if he's in the slot this season. But I think sticking Robbie Anderson with the speed element out there and DJ Moore, you're going to have a lot of speed and ability for Bridgewater to see different levels of this attack, because you've got players that I think can work at a variety of target depths with McCaffrey working really shallow stuff underneath. You're going to have options for Bridgewater. So I like that from this offense.
Which what you're describing is very similar to what Joe Brady did at LSU. Of course, Joe Brady knows Teddy from his days with the Saints. You know, I don't know how well he knows him or whatever, but they have the players to, and I think in Teddy, the brain to execute that sort of option, right? Or offense, pardon me, on offense. Well, option's a good word because there is a lot of, there are a lot of options in that LSU offense. It really is in the same way, I think what you saw with Burrow, who, you know, also doesn't have like the biggest arm, although it's not really, you would compare him to Teddy. Certainly he's shown more of a, in his one great year, a, willingness to take risks there. But, I think, you've got a quarterback who's very good at going through his reads, at throwing a catchable ball, at identifying matchups, which of course you saw LSU do so often out of empty. And I think that, you know, that's something that they have the ability to pull off in Carolina. The defense is rebuilding. Like, I know I just said, I don't know what's going on with this team, but the defense is, they are. I mean, Matt Rhule came in and ripped that baby apart. Well, not Matt Rhule, but, you know, we saw they went all defense in the draft. You can quibble about whether it was a good idea to take a defensive tackle in Derek Brown instead of like an Isaiah Simmons there, but it's very young. They're really across the board at every level. I think this defensive line has, Brian Burns was very good last year. They also drafted Yetur Gross-Matos. And of course Short comes back. I think they're going to go back to a 4-3 now with Brown and Short. I think the front seven could be good actually and could be better than expected, but this secondary is not good. They're just not good, Warren. I don't have a lot. I mean, I like, again, Jeremy Chinn, fun draft pick, but they're just not there yet.
Yeah. And the problem is when you don't have a good secondary and your defense is so young, it's going to take time, and they've got the second toughest schedule in the NFL, actually, sorry, third toughest schedule based on my numbers projected of opposing offenses that they're going to face. And they also don't have the benefit of an early bye week. I mean, I think that gets underestimated at times, but with a young coordinator in a season like we're having a young coach, new offense, new quarterbacks, like that early bye week gives teams the ability to reset, fix some things. A lot of self-scouting goes on there. They don't have that. Their bye week is the last one you could possibly get, which is week 13. So that's not a benefit to a first-year coach, and you're playing a schedule of really good offenses. What that translates to is playing from behind, something Teddy Bridgewater didn't have to do quite as much with the Saints. And the Saints, you know, obviously they've got 13-3 record, so they're playing with the lead most of the time. And playing from behind is a different story. Obvious passing situations put more stress on the O-line, on what the quarterback is asked to do. So there are definitely some things that are going to be playing against them as a playing against the offense as a result of how young, inexperienced, and kind of quickly put together this defense in the front's going to be, and how bad it is in the back.
As always, let's wrap with five questions for our guest.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
Question one. Which team wins the NFC South?
I'm going to go with the Saints. I'm going to go with the Saints.
You going Saints, Bucks, Falcons, Panthers?
Yep, exactly. Exactly how it's planned. I do think that there's the possibility for the Falcons to have a little bit of a lower floor if some of the injury stuff doesn't go quite their way. I mean, this is a team that was actually, you know, if they get some the injury issues that crop up, that could be a factor. They were the fifth healthiest team last season. So if that happens and their defense isn't improved like we saw at the second half of the last year, I mean, I think they could drop down closer to where Carolina is. But yeah, I think that 1-4 is probably right.
Question two. So I alluded to this, but you guys remember we drafted quarterbacks here on our podcast with Nate Tice. There was an ESPN draft where everybody redrafted for their teams amongst all the players in the NFL. It was fun because it got a lot of people fighting. Let me ask you this, Warren. I'm not going to ask you about a draft, but one thing a lot of people noticed that a lot of people were like, Drew Lock over Kyler Murray, what? You know, and I tweeted that I was high on, I think I was higher on Kyler and Stafford than apparently my peers. Who's a quarterback that you feel like you might be higher on than the consensus?
You know, I would not disagree with you on Kyler. I think that more people are jumping onto that bandwagon.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, heading into the off season, I was impressed with what I saw out of Drew Lock, just looking at the results of the games and some of the things that I saw. But then when I dug into it, I mean, Denver Broncos fans aren't going to like the chapter that I wrote on the Broncos, because I found a lot that I didn't like about Drew Lock, and I hope that I'm wrong, but there were definitely some red flags there in some of what I saw. I think a guy who was, I don't know if he was a media darling, I think you did a big piece on him too a year or so ago, but it basically left off the map right now. Nobody's really talking about it. Baker Mayfield could really rebound this season. With Kevin Stefanski as coordinator, I think Baker Mayfield potentially could have a really surprising season that a lot of people aren't expecting this year.
That's a good one. Certainly has the weapons to do so, and that's going to be a tough division, man. We'll get there. We'll get to the AFC North, but it's those three teams, and with the Bengals no longer being totally, I think they're going to be a little bit better too. I think they're one of the better divisions in football, so we'll talk about that. I've been asking everyone this, question three. What is a quarantine content recommendation you have for people? A book, a TV show, a movie, something you have enjoyed recently?
All right. Well, obviously, this is just about me, so I'll share a little bit into why I'm doing this. But pretty much my schedule is I do as much as I can during the day. I've got two kids that are both being homeschooled like everybody else in this country. And so my time to work during the day, I'm still cranking, but it's not quite as productive as it was when they're both in school for, you know, 7 or 8 hours. I end up, like, after dinner and getting the kids to bed, I am working from like 10 p.m., 9:30, 10 p.m. until about 2:30 a.m. Like, hardcore, no interruptions, take the dog out once. Other than that, I'm focused on work. I'm drinking my Diet Cokes and just cranking through. But at 2:30, pretty much every night, I have a hard stop. And I throw on Curb Your Enthusiasm. I throw an episode of Curb on, and I basically fall asleep to it at night. So, yeah, it's that alone. Like, I don't know if you even like the show, but I watched season 10 live during the beginning part of quarantine. I thought it was tremendous. It was on, you know, this like in March, I guess, in April. But then I went back. I tried to start at season one. The quality of the filming, that's important to me, I guess. I'm an idiot, but I know the comedy was surely there, but the quality of the filming wasn't quite as good, like the camera quality. So I think I picked up like season 3 or 4, and I've been watching it all the way through since that point.
I think about the episode with John Hamm like every day. Just thinking about it makes me laugh so much. I haven't seen all the seasons, but I did watch the latest, and intermittently I've watched it. It's nice to laugh. I'll just say that. Okay, question four. let's say like the NBA, the NHL, whatever. Let's just say we went straight to the NFL postseason. Who would win?
Oh, so who are we allowing to make it to that far? We're just
every team. Sorry. So it's like a March Madness style one game, single elimination, every team start to finish.
Oh, wow. Look, I feel like you're going to bring out a little bit of the backyard element when you do that, you know, just like single elimination. You don't know who you're going to get. Maybe you don't have as much time to prepare so we can finish the season quicker. I think that definitely helps a team that's led by Patrick Mahomes and Andy yeah. Reid. I mean, their ability to just
agree.
Yeah, we fall behind, but so what? We'll get back into it. Like no other team can do that. And I think that is one of the single most important factors for like a tournament like that. So I will go with them.
Yeah, I think so too. The only thing I'll say is like, I think when you factor in the defense and how defenses normally get better as the season goes on and health, I think the Niners do have them there. But I just think the Mahomes factor is I'd go Chiefs too. All right, last question, as always, comes from my co-host Lenny. This is written by him, not me. I'm just the messenger. Lenny noticed that you and some of the other nerds on Twitter, his words, have been talking a lot of crap about running backs, and he just wants to know if you would say it to their faces.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I would probably state it in a little bit of a different manner. Like, I would tone it down a lot. Like, if I was talking to Christian McCaffrey, I mean, these guys, this is their livelihood, this is their career, so they take it very personally, and they work just as hard at their craft as anybody else in the NFL. So it's not their fault that their position is becoming a little bit more devalued, but it's also not my fault as an analyst. So I think the important part is just the way that you present things and the decorum that you bring to the table. And I definitely think that that's lacking right now at various high levels around our country, let's say. But it's important the way that you present and express yourself. And I think if you do it the right way, they'll differ in their opinion, but they won't hate you as much as they would if you just said that literally, you know, the show where they read the mean tweets like directly to the person. Like,
yeah.
If they read our mean tweets, then that would be really offensive and they would hate us.
That reminds me when we did the NFL panel at Sloan and Saquon Barkley was supposed to be on it, but then he didn't make it at the last second. And I have to say, I was a little bit relieved.